Welcome back to Open Mind. I'm Keith Barry, and today we're diving into the mind of Fergus Farrell. Fergus is the absolute definition of resilience. After a devastating spinal cord injury left him paralyzed, he was told he'd never walk again. But within a year, he proved them all wrong, walking 206 kilometers across Ireland, along with many intense endurance challenges since. He's worked his way up from rock bottom to rebuild his life, and now shares the powerful message that true strength comes from vulnerability, honesty, and refusing to give up. Fergus, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Keith. Great to be here.
There's a lot going on there, Fergus. But yeah. take us back to the start. Before your injury, so I follow rugby. I've followed rugby for many, many years. So I know you as a Connacht rugby player. But for people out there who might not know you, tell us, what was life like before your injury, and what was day-to-day activity like?
So before the injury, I was in the business world, a bus and coach industry, 24/7, go, 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 no time for anything, just moment to moment to moment. Prior to that then, as a young boy, I was a farmer's son, saving hay, saving turf, building stone walls, good upbringing, because outside earning, working hard. But I was very lucky, my parents instilled in me, early on that, work hard and you get a reward.
Yeah.
With that understanding, I always applied that to my life, work hard and there will be some sort of reward at the end of it. And from that, then I fell in love with rugby and soccer. I actually played a little bit more soccer when I was younger.
Okay.
I gave up rugby for a while because I actually love soccer as well. But played the rugby, and luckily enough, I got to play for my club, and then I got to play with the Connacht underages and then the Irish underages team, and then I went on to play with the Connacht juniors and so on. And I did that in the soccer as well. I got to play for like my local club, Athenry, Galway Towns, and Connacht as well in the soccer. But it wasn't skill set. It was just, putting the head down, train hard, and see where that brings you. And then from there, then obviously about 23, 24, started falling in love with socialising a little bit too much.
Yeah.
And then ended up being going into the business world, the bus and coach world, which is it's a tough industry. Mm. You never get a break from it.
Did you own your own bus and coach?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had, at the end of it, I had 35 coaches, wow. 65 staff. It looked amazing because all my coaches were pretty new as well, but heavily financed.
Yeah.
So I was under a lot of pressure. Mm. And like a year before the accident happened, I actually lost a contract. And that started putting huge pressure on me as a person and business. But we won the award off that contract. I also remember winning it and I was like, yes, this is going to give me breathing space. We'll get the award, the money that was awarded. And I'd work my ass off to get to that point.
Yeah.
And all they did was reply back, big multinational, just reply back saying, sorry, we don't stand over this judgment. And I remember that happening. I go, how can they do that to us?
Yeah.
Because
there's no recourse from that for you, no?
Well, the next recourse, because the value was so high off the reward, I had to bring it to the High Court.
Yeah.
And that's years and massive money, which I didn't have because my business was drowned at the time. Drowning in debt because I was heavily leveraged, and that loss of that contract was put in severe. We lost 25,000 per week cash flow.
Wow.
Gone.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah, huge. And then we did vehicles doing nothing, which is even worse again. At the same time, then also I had secured the Mercedes-Benz franchisee for the West of Ireland for the bus and coach industry, which I had worked so hard for because that was like, to get that, they don't hand it out to everybody.
Yeah.
And to be able to get it and to sign off that contract. That was everything coming together perfectly for me, and then it started unraveling. So while my bus business started losing money, which was originally meant to, the profits from that was meant to, establish the Mercedes-Benz franchisee, it all started caving in together. And I mean, just, I can't even describe how crippling it was. But again, like that, from what I knew from a young lad boy, I just put my head down and just stayed working and working and working, and hopefully I could get through it. And I always remember only a few weeks before the accident happened to me, I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. I was here going, oh man, look at all this hard work is beginning to pay off. I'm getting there slowly. Yeah. And then the accident happened.
I've read your book and I know what happened in the accident, and it seems, I suppose, to try and comprehend that you're just lifting something and helping somebody lift something, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere, this freak accident, if that's the right terminology to use, just happens for such a strong person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So describe what happened for us.
So the actual accident, I was literally lifting up a rustic bench. It was 60 to 80 kgs. Same bench I would have lifted many times my own. I would have, you know, pulled it into the waist and done the duck walk with it, you know?
yeah.
You know, simple as. Because it wasn't particularly, like, for a big lad, it wasn't particularly heavy.
Yeah.
Maybe awkward, but it wasn't heavy. But because I had a white shirt on that day, I was about to drive a busload of rugby players to Northern Ireland.
Okay.
My actual local club. I was really looking forward to it because drive them to Belfast, had a few pints that night, then watched them play in Northern Ireland quarter final the next day. Game I love watching. What isn't there to love about it?
I'm sorry, what year was this?
2018.
Okay,
2018. So, picked up the bench, but I picked it up from my body like that, you know, because I didn't want to get the white shirt dirty.
Yeah.
And Sean was on the other side. When I lifted it, I dropped it after about 10 or 15 steps. And when I dropped it, just an awful pain ran up my back, a pain I hadn't felt before. Yeah. You know pain.
Mm.
And I dropped it and I bent over, you know, with the pain. I took in, again, don't hold me to this, but like 10 or 12 really deep breaths.
Yeah.
Going, oh man, I was saying to me, I wasn't saying out loud, I was saying in my head, oh man, that's sore. But like that, I was saying it internally. I didn't want to be showing off any weakness because, you know, again, big man, you know, all those things necessary with being a man, don't show weakness, don't show pain. And then eventually I recovered and I picked up that bench again and one step, bang, on the ground, roaring in pain. That was it, you know. I said, probably the worst thing that ever happened to me, but also probably the best thing.
But that's interesting that you say that now. And like, we'll go into the story if that's okay with you. But like, I'll be interested to find out in a few moments, like why it might be the, at least partially, the best thing that ever happened to you.
Yeah.
So you're down the ground. I'm assuming Sean called an ambulance or something then, didn't he? Or?
No, poor Sean was just looking at me, hadn't a clue what happened to me.
Because
at the end of the day, there was I on the ground, roaring in pain, but they wasn't scratching me.
Right, yeah.
So he's gone, what's after happening to this lad? And, you know, there's a bench on top of me, and eventually I got my breath. And when I got my breath, like I told him, go and get my wife. She was next door in the house. And so she went off, he went and called her, he ran off and called her and came back. And when he came back, this bench was still on top of me. I was still roaring in pain because like any fraction of a movement was just horrific.
Yeah.
And sure, the minute she see me, ring the ambulance.
Yeah.
You know, and the ambulance came out, and all fairness, they were incredible. So they were. So they got a compression suit around me fairly quickly after doing the analysis to see where I was and stuff like that. It got me in the ambulance, got me in. But as I went in then, Tommy Mahan, who was the paramedic, lovely man, he was, as we were getting in there, he said, this is unusual.
So Tommy's looking after you?
Yeah, and he was just kind of saying, usually if you come out with somebody with a back injury or something like that, they have like reduced pain by getting their movement or, you know, there's a sign of improvement.
Yeah.
But I was still roaring in pain, still no movement.
And where was the pain? Was it going down your legs at that time?
It was from my kind of belly button down.
Okay.
And obviously it was in my back too, but the main focus of my attention was my feet felt like they were just on fire. And that means it felt like plastic was melting into my skin. And nothing I did was relieved. Nothing.
Like,
they gave me the green whistle because that's the most they give you know, that pain.
He's in the ambulance now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I was sucking over like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah.
But nothing was happening. Mm. Nothing. So that's why he was, you know, concerned. In all fairness, he got me in and I could see him, you know, really pushing people in the A&E to kind of, this lad knows.
Yeah, prioritise this, yeah.
Yeah, he's not in a good way. And kind of then after that, then it was a bit of a blur. Had to get into the MRI machine then inside in the A&E. And I think my wife and my parents were in at this stage and even getting onto that MRI machine was, it's just a moment where I really struggled to, the accident part, no problems.
Yeah.
But afterwards is the part that I struggle most with because
you struggle like emotionally to recall or you struggle with the fact that you were behaving a certain way or what do you struggle with?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, because there's so much going on.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the recollection of the pain, but also like, I remember a nurse in there telling me to cop on because I was roaring so much in pain because they were trying to get me up onto this rollator bed that went into the MRI machine. And I couldn't cop on. The pain was just horrific.
Yeah.
But I'm here going, cop on. You know, I I can't understand that. So, you know, I got the MRI done, and when I got the, and I had to be in there, like, they told me I had to stay still for four. I've been in MRIs plenty of times.
Yeah.
So I knew you'd have to be still, and it was really confined space.
Yeah.
And doing the boom.
And the noise.
Yeah. So I knew all that, but I didn't realise it'd be so long. So when I was going into this thing, I was lying down on this rollator platform, and I was so sore, and I was told I had to stay still for 40, 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's a long time in an MRI, yeah.
Oh, man. And you're roaring in pain. Mm. And you're just going, 1 second, 2 second. You know, you're doing everything.
Get through.
But we did get through it. And then the far side, the doctor, Dr. Cullen, who was off duty at the time, came in. Again, I don't know how long it was. Mm. Sat down beside me and just kind of said, you're in trouble here. And I was like, going, really? And he said, yeah, you have 12 hours. You have a 12-hour window. We need to get you operated on. And after that, then he told me that they didn't have the expertise to do it there. So they were ringing Beaumont and the National Spinal Unit in the matter to see which one could take me. And Beaumont or Rishi said they could take me. So everything's been arranged to fly me to Beaumont.
Yeah.
So I actually remember the air ambulance coming down and landing. And next thing, they got the phone call from the spinal injury unit saying they actually have a bed and they'll take me. And that was the better option.
Okay.
Because they have, obviously, the National Spinal Injury Unit.
Specialist.
Yeah, exactly. And but they said they had to get another MRI done.
Oh, here we go again for you.
Yeah. Again, like, okay. For some reason, the second time seemed to be okay. I don't have much recollection of it other than getting it done. And but what I do remember then when they went to fly me up to Dublin, their ambulance they'd sent down couldn't land. Could fly at night, but couldn't land at night.
Oh.
Yeah. So I had to be blue lit to Dublin, yeah. So there was 2.5 hours of a journey up. That whole journey was like, I couldn't get over it, like just from the vibrating the gearbox and the engine.
And I think, do you remember, had they given you morphine and all the rest of it at that stage?
I presume they had.
Yeah.
I
can't, didn't matter though, right?
Not a thing, because I had my hand on it. It was like I had a hand on an electric fence.
Yeah.
I was just shock after shock after shock after shock. And oh, man.
And had they given you the diagnosis at that stage? They told you what had happened to the spine after the MRI?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay.
They could have put him to you and everything. I knew nothing about spine now, so they could have told me and I would have went over my head. But I don't think they had.
Yeah.
I definitely don't recall.
So you get down.
Yeah.
You get down to the National...
National Spinal Injury.
And then, so they operate on you straight away when you get in?
Well, this is the funny thing, is like, you know, they told us to get an MRI, you think they're expecting me. I arrived up there and I was like, who are you?
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah.
And next thing, and they started organising the room.
Yeah.
And the room was right beside the reception area.
Okay.
And I was remembering that. And then I went in there and obviously they asked me to sign off a waiver form, you know, operation, whether it was going to be 8.5, 9 hours, they were saying. And then they had to weigh me. And that's where I realised where I was in my life.
Right.
I was seriously obese.
Oh, were you? Okay.
Yeah, I was 123 kgs, you know, and that was just my lifestyle.
Yeah, just working. Probably
working,
work.
Rubbish,
yeah.
Lack of sleep, stress, everything.
Yeah.
But I didn't have time to understand any of that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even believe in stress
in
life. I didn't believe it
because
I didn't have time to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, and then I went to obviously had the operation and.
Well, we'll talk about the operation and the outcome of that and the other things that happened to you subsequently. But the reason I said it to you on the way in here today, the reason I align with your story somewhat is, like a lot of people don't know, I was in a massive car accident back in 2007. And
I knew that.
It was a head-on car collision. And I was doing about 60 miles an hour. The other guy was doing about 60 miles an hour. And he came from the other side of the road and hit me bang on. So that's a 120 mile an hour collision. And I went into a spin and I hit a wall. When I looked down, my foot was wrapped up around my shin going the wrong way. But I can just align my story. Whilst yours is obviously a far, I suppose, more serious injury that you had, I think there's an alignment between certain people who go through such trauma. And then you had your operation. What was the outcome of the operation? What did the doctors tell you? Because they told me I'd have a limp for the rest of my life, which I don't have.
Yeah.
And that's why I can relate to you. And they told you something far worse than what they told me.
Yeah, so basically on the day two, This is when I first remember being told exactly what happened to me. So basically, surgeon came in, sat down beside me. And bear in mind this stage, like, I knew I was, I'd already said to him the day before, and he hadn't told me what it was. I just basically said to him, I looked at my two emotional feet that I couldn't connect with, couldn't touch, couldn't move, couldn't do anything, still roaring, still in horrific pain. I was drugged up to my eyes. Is this the way I'm going to be? And I looked up to him, and he sat down beside me and put his hand on my shoulder and said, you've been very, very unlucky, Fergus. So that was my first realisation of, oh, man. So I did go into a very dark place there and then, really there and then. I won't, you know, and that's all there in the book. But the next day he came in and he sat down beside me and I said, now, Fergus, this is basically what's happened to you. You're a grade A spinal cord injury. You rupture your T9, T10, and the T10 has gone through your spinal cord and severed it by 90%.
Right.
In the medical world, they call it pinching. And again, that meant nothing to me. You know, but basically said, okay, these are the stats. If you get some sort of movement in the next 72 hours, you have a 5% of getting some sort of strength. He didn't say walking, just strength. And then he said, okay, but however, if you don't get anything in the next 72 hours, your stats are zero. I was like going, okay. So he's kind of saying to me, it's now or never. So I remember at that stage, I must have said to myself, look, I have to use the tools I have in my box. And one was, I knew how to work hard. Really instilled in me as a young boy. But I started using visualization, which I used all the time.
I think this is fascinating because I've heard you say before, it wasn't the time to invent new methods. Use the tools you have in your box. That really resonated with me because very often I think people are looking for kind of like a quick fix, or they're looking for the pill, or they're looking for the magic dust or the magic potion or whatever. I think there's something to be really taken from that. Like, use the tools that are already in your box. You don't need to look external all the time. You don't need to look, find the next trick or the next thing. It's what you already have that you can utilize in that exact moment. And I think that's really fascinating for me.
Okay. Well, look, it's just something I did. Because I had to. You know, when you're left with very few options, I do think you will go to places that you never thought you would ever have to go to or ever thought you could go to. And obviously that was how I went to that place.
And what were those tools? So work hard.
Work hard. Visualization. I used visualization years ago when I wanted to. I always remember like wanting to be playing rugby for Ireland. And I always remember running around, like I'd be running around my front garden, which had stationary trees. And I had the rugby ball around under my arm, pretending I'm a winger, even though I'm a prop. trying to dodge these stationary trees. But it was all that visualization process. But I did it in smaller things as well. But also, like, I remember when I had the bus business, I visualized owning my first new bus. But again, I always visualize about things that I can impact. Otherwise, I think it's just dreaming.
That's really
And you're setting yourself up for big fails.
I always say that. If you dream about a Lamborghini landing outside your front door, it's not landing outside your front door.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
It's not. No, exactly. You know, it's something that you can really, like, I never visualize about winning the national lotto numbers because I can't impact that machine. I can impact what I can impact. And that's why I went down that route. Work hard and visualize. And I visualized moving my big right toe. And again, why did I visualize my big right toe? Because if I visualize about jumping out of that bed and walking out that door, that was never going to happen. So start small and build. Because that's what I did all through my life. Everything was, you know, I wasn't the person who had the silky skills and who could, you know, walk on water and all that. Everything I did was all through hard work. So I knew that if I start, if I could get this big right toe moving, I'm going to use the tools in my box to get it moving, and then I'll build from there. That was kind of what was going through my head. And also the idea that, you know, every day was a day to improve.
And I know you saw a circuit board in the hospital room that helped you with that.
So and to this day, I don't even know if it was a circuit board, but that's what I thought it was. And so there's a circuit board up on the top left-hand side of the room, and the switch is on the right-hand side. And while I was lying in bed with all these wires and everything popping over me, and it was kind of something to fill the mind, to stop the mind from, you know,
spiraling.
Spiraling, exactly, so I visualized that that circuit board was my brain. That switch on the wall, I could if I moved my big right toe, I could turn that on. If I turned it on, that light above me would turn on. And that was me making that full circuit. I repairing that broken spinal cord, and the circuit board was my head, my brain, and the switch, my big right toe is right beside that switch. And if I move that toe, bang. And I just remember I would visualize a spark coming out of my brain, going right down through my body, down through my groin, down through my broken spinal cord, down through the groin, calf, toe. Did this hundreds of times. That's what I did.
And did,
that's
it
what I knew how to
and
do.
Did it move eventually? Or how long did it take before it moved?
21 days.
So it didn't happen in those 72 hours that the doctor so did the doctors after that 72 hours then give you the bad news that they thought this was permanent, or
I don't remember how they did it to me, but basically they think they'd sown the seed on the second day when they said 72 hours you have to you know, if you get something, you know, there's a chance.
Yeah.
After that there isn't a chance. But like, it's my life. What else are you going to be doing, lying flat in the bed in the hospital? Like, I was so paralyzed. Two nurses' aides would have to come in and move me every 2 hours onto my shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
And come back, move me onto the back and move me onto the other shoulder. So that was a 6 hour cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how dependent I'd come. So what was I going to do? Lie in that bed and feel sorry for myself? And so I kind of also started this thought process, like, look, like, I didn't know where I was going to go.
Yeah.
Really didn't know where to go. So to stay positive, stay going, I just took on that kind of idea that no matter what I do, when I get home, I'm going to be better in some sort of shape or form.
Yeah.
Whether that was be fast in the wheelchair, to be able to make myself a cup of tea, all these things, just that I'd be better when I get home. Because if I can't go home like this. And that's kind of what kept me going. It kept me going, and that hard work and the visualization, and ultimately I moved after 21 days. Yeah.
And how was that moment for you? Like, were you alone when they moved?
I was, I was. It was crazy. Like,
were you in bed? Were you on the couch?
I was in bed. I was half two.
In the morning? In the
morning, yeah. It's the worst time to do anything in the hospital. There's literally nobody around.
Yeah.
And there's just silence.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I had my laptop, and I think I must have been watching some Netflix. I was definitely on that. I remember being on, you know, laptop.
Yeah.
And I moved it aside, and again, there was literally no sleep going on all this time.
Yeah.
Like, it was, the only way I was able to sleep was pure exhaustion.
Yeah.
And I'd nod off. I'd wake up 10 or 15 minutes
later. Yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of way.
Yeah.
And so I started visualizing again. And next thing I thought, I'd seen this. I always use the scent because it's my right. I seen this. I thought I moved like that.
Yeah.
I was going, is that really after happening? And I was going, I was sure it happened, but at the same time, you know, you've been so long trying to move this thing. I started thinking, maybe I'm only hallucinating. Maybe I'm going crazy. All these things were going through my head, because I had 4 hours before I knew a guy would come in, Gary, who would come in and see me.
Yeah.
He was the nurse's aide who would come in and unfortunately stick a depository up my bum.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he came in that morning, I just, Gary, I nearly blew him back through the door with the excitement, you know?
Of course. Must be unbelievable for you.
Yeah, and I asked him, like, I think I'm after moving my big right toe. And he said, really, Gussie, my nickname is Gussie. And he just, this is a bit blurry, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, I get it.
But he asked me to move it for him, but it's not like you can move your toe.
I know, yeah, yeah.
It's there's no connection, no, and when you can't feel it then as well, you know, it's just real surreal feeling. And I had to go through that whole process.
Yeah.
And eventually moved. I said, see, that's after moving. I was delighted. I said, I'm going to go and get the nurse and tell her. So the nurse came in at 7:30, they were changing duties. And she came in. And I did the same thing. But again, it wasn't like come in, move the toe and the go. It could take 2 or 3 minutes or longer for it to move. And that happened. And then the next, Dr. Cullen, who used to always come in to me at the end of the round, because I was only taking up a bed until I could get to the NRH.
Right.
Like, I was lights out, grade A spinal cord injured person. You know, that's all I was there for.
Yeah.
But obviously it hurt that I'd maybe moved the big right toe. And he came in the morning with his entourage. And I always remember, like, he said, "Now, I've heard, Fergus, you might have movement in one of your toes." And I said, "Yeah, yeah." And, like, obviously beaming.
Yeah.
You know? And first thing he said to me, "Now, Fergus, these could be involuntary spasms." I was here going, talk about kicking loud when you're down.
Yeah, like, knock your confidence.
Yeah, yeah. So eventually I went through that whole process. You know, bear in mind now, this is mentally and emotionally just draining.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever went through such a draining experience. And eventually moved again. But he repeated the same thing. These could be involuntary spasms.
Right.
And I moved it again. And eventually he asked me to move one more time. And the third time, I moved it again. Now, that took a while. I think that 4 or 5 minutes before.
Okay.
I moved. Like everybody's like going, yeah, there are spasms.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I saw a little bit of it. Yeah, but I'll never forget. He stood back. He's a big man, 6'4". And I said, Fergus, that's most unexpected. And I mean, I still got shivers think about now. Yeah. Because that's, you know, once you have progress, it's quite easy to stay positive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, because you can see gains. You can see physical gains, you know. Physical gains are very measurable. Mental health isn't measurable. Really,
yes,
is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and from that moment onwards, like obviously I latched onto the mental health, the physical gains to keep me positive. But that wasn't everything that was going on, like, you know.
So I've read a lot about the toe, but did you continue to visualize, like, second toe and a third? Like, talk me through how you progressed on from there with your visualization.
Everything was visualization. So it was. Like, everything was visualization.
Yeah.
Yeah. And more I used it, the more I realized I used visualization when I was younger.
Yeah.
In lesser things. But I always thought I was only using it on the
Did it come
things.
Naturally to you, visualization? Like, do you think it was just something that came to you, like, when you were young, like you just mentioned?
Yeah.
And then, did you ever see anybody inspirational outside that you went, Jesus, that person talked a lot of sense about visualization? Or was it just something that naturally came to you?
I think it's something that just naturally came to me. I don't remember any moment whereby, oh, wow, look at that, that's class, or listen to anybody.
Yeah.
You know, we grew up in a different era. Like, you know, there wasn't podcasts, there wasn't, you know, there's RTE1 and Network 2 and TV. Yeah. So I don't think I would have seen anybody or done anything. And my family aren't sporting families neither, you know. So, no, I think it's just something that came to me.
Have you investigated it further as life has gone on, or have you just stayed in your own lane? And
I'm quite comfortable with it. And,
well, because it's working for you,
yeah,
right?
That's the thing. Exactly, yeah. You know, and I still use it, like, you know, I use it a lot.
Right, the reason I'm probing this so much is I just think there's so many people out there struggling with a lot of different things, right?
Yeah.
And I think they need to understand there's so much hope to be gained from this conversation. Mm. Like, the fact that you were in such an awful accident and which is such a horrible predicament, and here we are sitting, like, Fergus walked in here, you wouldn't know that you're in a mad accident like that, like, you know.
No one yourself with your
yeah. And with me, look, prognosis was I have a limb for the rest of my life, and I in that exact moment I started laughing at them, and they were like, what are you laughing at? I said, I'm going to phone my promoter now, who was Aiken Promotions at the time, and I'm going to book Vicar Street. Yeah. I'm going to book Vicar Street 3 months from now, and I'm going to walk on with no limp. So
you,
I did.
You were setting yourself a challenge.
Exactly. Yeah. But then I got into the visualization, just like you spoke about. Ultimately, I walked on stage with no limp.
Yeah.
And the reason I just want to probe this for a moment is, like, I don't think it came naturally to me. So that's where we're different, right?
Okay.
So with me, I started learning hypnosis when I was 14. So that's when I started learning about the power of the mind.
Mm.
And I started to really become a voracious student of the power of visualization and the human mind. So I kind of learned from a lot of other people, right?
Right.
What I want to know from you is, when you are visualizing, like you mentioned there, you're running around with the rugby ball and the trees and stuff. But when you're in hospital, were you doing it eyes open, staring at your toe, or were you closing your eyes sometimes? Talk me through the process, because people listening, they might start to use, not necessarily your process, but a version of your process for anything that they want to use it for. So talk us through that.
So when I'm visualizing, it's always my eyes closed.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't just visualize generic things. It's really fine detail.
Okay.
You know, as in the brain, that spark going through your spinal cord. And like, I didn't just visualize and 1 second later, I'm down with a big right
throw.
I took the time, and it would go down through my neck, down through my broken spinal cord.
Yeah.
And it would hover there for a little while. And I would mix it up as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so there's many different ways of doing it.
Yeah.
So that's how I used visualization in that moment. Mm. But it was also a way of occupying the mind.
Yeah.
And again, like that, like I haven't studied any of this or and it's just something that has come naturally to me.
Yeah.
So I don't even know how to really quantify, you know, not quantify it, but I don't even know how.
But
really
the
how
science
to,
is catch. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I've studied it, right? And the science is catching up on it. So ultimately, most likely, what's happening, even though we can't say exactly, right? But most likely, what's happening is you're creating new neural pathways.
Yeah.
Through that visualization, because scientifically speaking, that is something that happens to us every moment of every day. We're creating new neural pathways. And depending on what you focus on, you become and you create those new neural pathways. So whatever way you are creating those neural pathways in your mind helped you in whatever shape, manner, or form to start to heal your body.
Yeah.
And people need to understand there's real power in this because, look, a lot of people are struggling with a lot of different ailments and things and sickness and, you know, just mental health and stress and anxiety and depression. But if they just take this one small thing from this conversation, it is that the power of visualization cannot be underestimated, is what I would say. That doesn't mean that it's for every single person in the world, but just those people out there who might be just distraught and think that they've tried everything. Yeah. I hear that all the time. I've tried everything. But just, you haven't tried everything. I know that there's always hope is my point.
So that was one thing. I was a very closed mind, even though I did visualization all my life, you know. But when it came to trying new things, I was a very closed mind. I was that person who just felt work hard, earn a living, provide, and repeat.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have been a person who would have tried Anton, even acupuncture, any of that type of stuff. I was sort of like, when I wanted to train, I went out to the rugby pitch or the gym and trained. And that was me, very closed mind. But when I had the accident, I had, again, options.
Yeah.
Either open up this mind of mine and look at other alternatives to help me, because I was determined to do everything in my power to improve my situation.
Yeah.
You know, that accident, like when you had your accident, right? That was the worst I was going to be.
Yeah.
It's now time to get better.
Yeah.
It's not get worse, get better. So I opened up my mind. And I opened up my mind. No, I didn't go mad into, you know, mad things. But I just, like, I did reflexology, acupuncture. I started doing cold plungings and all these things that I wouldn't have dreamt of doing. Like, now I don't even have hot showers. I have cold showers constantly because I enjoy them so much, you know, and I feel the benefits of it and so on. But, like, so going back to your point, like, you know, when I opened up my mind, it has helped me massively in every aspect of my life, because I now see things differently. I react differently to situations, all those things, with that open mind.
Yeah.
And so, again, well, why I'm saying that is because, you know what I'm saying about visualizing might not be for everybody, but if you don't try it, you don't know.
That's it. And try consistently for, I always say to people, try consistently for at least 6 weeks before you expect the result.
Yeah.
Like in your case, think about it logically. Like you were paralyzed and within 21 days, now you'd done it before, but within 21 days you saw a result.
Yeah.
So I say to people, if you've never done it before, try it for at least 6 weeks without expecting a result, and then start to expect results maybe after 6 weeks. Yeah. But some people see results straight away. Some people see it could take 6 weeks. Yeah. But most people, I will say, not everyone, but most people will see a result of some kind. And it could be a small result after 6 weeks, is what I say, you know.
And so I tried the reflexology, which was a really, really weird.
Is reflexology? Just so people understand it.
So it's different points in your feet that, you know, can heal and different parts of your body and stuff like that. Again, don't ask me full science of it, but...
No.
Like, I know, like, I still have very, very, very reduced sensation in my feet. Like, put it aside, I could be playing footsie with you and I would not.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and there's loads of all those types of things
going on. Let's try that in a while. Take off our shoes.
I thought we were doing it already, you know.
Instead of an arm wrestle, we'll have a foot wrestle.
So basically, I was, that actually, I'll tell you a story. My best mate was sitting across me, and it wasn't long after the accident I was on my feet, but we went to a restaurant in Athenry called the Old Barracks, and Paul was there and the wife was there. Actually, she started looking at me funny. I was going, what's going on? Like, I was like, what are you okay there, Fergus? And I was like, I looked under, oh, sorry, you know, it could get you in a lot of trouble. So good. But so going back to the point.
Talking about reflexology,
I was like, I could see her touching my feet, but I couldn't feel, I could see her, but I couldn't feel it.
Yeah.
I could feel it all up around every, like, you know, where it's meant to be affecting.
Is that interesting? Yeah. And do you think that was visualization or is it actually working?
I think it was actually working.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, I just could feel all these tingles and I was like going, something's happening down there. I don't know what's happening down there, but I'm feeling it in other parts of my body. But that's why I feel my body reacts totally different to a lot of different situations now these days, you know, than what I used to. But now it's the norm for me. So yeah, that's then. And even the acupuncture, like I went to several different acupuncturists because I was full sure that it would benefit me in some way or another. And I literally landed on, after I think it was the third one, a amazing woman in Loughrea called Linda Heffernan. And after coming out of that place, again, I just felt the improvement there and then.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why. Amazing. It was just the body felt so much more relaxed, or I don't know what it was, but I just felt something.
So tell me, how long did your recovery take then from the moment you moved your toe and the day that you, or days that you got back on your feet?
So actually, I'll just calculate that now. So it was 21 days and then I was out at the end. So that would have been, I never calculated this before.
Here we go.
So yeah.
See how long it takes to get from being paralysed to back on your feet.
21 days is around the 15th of November. And then I walked out through the doors at Inner H. I think it was the 3rd or 4th of April. So what's that?
6 months odd, something like that?
5 months, yeah. Something like that, yeah.
Like, that's a fast recovery from such a
when I walked out through the doors, if you put your fingers on me and push me, I would have fallen.
Yeah.
So it was more symbolic. I was on my feet.
Yeah.
I was able to walk down the ramp to my car and hop in and drive home.
Yeah.
I learned how to drive with hand controls. But if I had to walk any further, like the physio and her assistant were either side of me, absolutely shitting a brick that was about to fall over.
I remember the exact same thing. Like, I came back from, I pulled strings. I actually went to Anfield for my physio. But I can relate to what you're saying, because I came back and I stood in front of my wife, Mairead, and I hadn't weight-bared in months. Like, I was on crutches, and I left one crutch back in Anfield, and I came back and I was like, watch this, Mairead. Yeah. And I just threw away the other crutch and I just stood in front of her. I was like, this is deadly.
And I was like,
all it was me standing there. Like, it's deadly.
Yeah.
And she was just like, and I think I started crying like in that moment and everything. But that was, and then obviously, look, you obviously built on that, but I know you hit troubled times after that with your marriage and other things. Do you want to talk us through like some of the, because it's in the book. And
Like, look, I don't understand it, you know. I did what I did at the time, but I really don't understand. Well, looking back on it, I think I might have an understanding.
Yeah.
But whether that is actually why, I don't know.
And what did you do?
I started talking to girls online.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, why? Well, I, looking back on it, I think I was just looking for an distraction. But also, one thing I always say in my talks is, what killed me as a person, as a human being, when I got out of the Inner H. Now, I know I started talking to them in the Inner H, but when I got out of the Inner H, it was people who used to look at me in respect, and including my loved ones, now looked at me in pity.
Right.
Because I had a disability.
Okay.
A severe one. And that really killed me in here.
Mm.
So I think it was to talk to somebody who didn't know my situation.
Okay. Yeah.
And that I wasn't always getting that thing, how are you doing? Are you doing okay?
Mm.
And the lowering of that voice and all those things that we do
without even
knowing it.
Well, you said you were such a masculine person, that pity factor really probably hit you hard.
It really did, yeah. So I think, that's only what I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Obviously, I was on a lot of drugs, medication, all that type of stuff. So I'll never know the full answer to that. But it's I can't take it back.
Yeah,
that's it. And that's why it's in the book. Like, you know, it's,
I'm
just trying to be honest to who I am and what my story is. Like, you know, and if I omitted that part, it'd be like I'm not being true to the story, not being true to myself.
That must have been really tough writing that from that personal perspective. See,
I'm uncomfortable now talking about it. It is. But again, I want to do a book to help people.
Yeah.
So am I hiding in that book and not telling it right?
Mm.
I'm fooling myself and fooling a lot of people.
But then you started getting into the endurance stuff then as well. Yeah. So it's quite the story.
Yeah.
You went through what you went through. And what was your first endurance challenge after your recovery?
Yeah, so I walked across Ireland.
And what year was that?
1 year after my anniversary of the accident. So 26th of October.
Like, that's mental. Sorry to interrupt, but like, what was your training like for that? Like, you're obviously still recovering. I mean, it's only a year after.
It was all about part of being my recovery. It was all about, you know, having to. So, look, obviously I went down that slide where I didn't want to be here.
Yeah.
And it was obviously a very dark moment, but also helped me to be where I am now because I went into the psychiatric ward for 7 days. First 3 days, I was as angry as you could ever get. Because they fooled me. The first one, they told me I could sign myself in, but also sign myself out. So I was thinking, I'll go in that night, sign myself out the next day when I've calmed down. No, they told me, no, you're a risk to yourself. We can't sign you out.
Yeah.
So that took me another few days to calm down. But then those last 4 days, just that silence, that time to myself, time. Just to be, and I said to myself, if I don't sort myself out now, I've come down a ladder. If I go back up the same ladder, I'll be back in here again.
Yeah.
And I just said, this is my time now to figure out what's going on in my life. Why have I ended up here?
Yeah.
You know, I got out of dinner, on my feet. I should be the proudest man going.
Yeah.
Now, my business was failing, my marriage was failing, my relationship with my kids was like, I had a 6-month-old son. I had no relationship with him because I hadn't seen him for another 6 months after that. And 6 months before that, I was too busy to have a relationship with him.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So when I was in there, I just, you know, I said, this is my time. And I figured out I need challenges and competition in my life.
Okay.
And that's what keeps me straight and narrow. So when I got out, I set about walking across the country, 206 kilometres, and I gave myself 3.5 months to do it.
Right.
And I knew if I did that, I would do it, no matter what.
Yeah.
It was my challenge, my life, and I'd do it. And bear in mind, I could walk maybe 100 metres at the time.
Yeah.
Maximum.
Amazing.
Yeah. But I knew if I did it, if I challenged myself hard enough, that I would do it, because anytime I'd set challenges in my life, big challenges, I would do it, you know.
How do you train for something like that, though? Like, were you walking on a treadmill seven miles a day or ten miles a day? Or were you just like sitting at home going, I'm going to visualise this and then I'm going to get up and do it?
Yeah, well, one of the good things is because I was disabled, I got a free travel pass.
Right.
So I used to get the train into Galway and walk up and down the Prom 20 times. Mm. And, you know, first of all, I remember the very first day. So I was still, when I got out of the psychiatric ward, I got back into my home.
Yeah,
where my wife lives for a few more weeks after that. And the first day when I left there to start this walk, there's a railway bridge very close to us, and it's very steep. It's not steep, but for me it was.
Yeah.
Because everything I'd done at that stage was a level walk.
Yeah, yeah.
And my first challenge was to get up to the top of that hill. And I remember getting to the top of that hill, and I was like, oh, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
Then I went down the other side, and I said, geez, that's not too bad. And I stayed going, and I got a lot further than I thought.
Yeah.
And I just said to myself, do you know something? I can push myself harder. And because of that, then I just stayed pushing and just had this, all everything I did was just around my own house.
Yeah, or, yeah.
You know, around little circles, and that's it.
So what was your,
one foot in front of the other.
So what was your latest endurance challenge in the last couple of months or years?
Well, I'm walking the Wild Atlantic Way at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm doing that in 10 sections, 260 kilometers, in between 260 and 300 kilometers per every 5 days. So I'm walking 50 to 60 kilometers a day. Such an amazing experience.
Yeah.
I've done, it's a 2 sections, 8 more to do. And the reason I'm doing that is because I'm walking across America next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And these for charity or just?
Yeah, so that's for Spinal Injuries Ireland.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're hoping to do a big fundraising campaign around it. I'd be the first person ever with a spinal cord injury to do it.
Amazing.
Yeah, but obviously I did Project Empower a few years ago. Failed at that, which hit me hard.
Failed which?
Project Empower, which is rowing across the North Atlantic Ocean with Damien Brown.
With Damien, I've had Damien on the podcast. People listen to that, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're going to go for that again, or?
No. I won't do anything in an ocean again, being honest with you.
Like that kind of stuff, right? I always take a step back for a moment.
Yeah.
Right? There's a certain level of inspiration with that stuff, but there's a certain level of, you're crazy with that stuff. that people will be thinking, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, listening. Yeah, right. Yeah.
It obviously gives you a sense of, does it give you a sense of purpose, peace? Like, you mentioned it earlier, but what's the real motivational force behind you doing these things?
I think it's mostly facets, really, to be honest with you. Number one is, you know, I put my kids through a lot.
Yeah.
They didn't deserve that. Not, you know, through that whole recovery and everything, and now being a divorced man and not having that family unit. So they'd be a huge driving force that I want to show them that, you know, if you want to put your mind to something, you can achieve it, you can do it. So I'm trying to be an actual, rather than just saying, I'm trying to actually show it.
Yeah.
That's number one.
But what's that juggle like for you when you're trying to show your kids, but obviously you want to be present for your kids as well, but then you're walking the wild and you're going to walk across America. How long is that going to take?
Yeah. So I'm hoping to walk across America 6 kilometers a day, 75 days in a row.
Okay.
So I've already, you know, I've spoke to my ex-wife in relation to that, and we've arranged everything like that. So when I'm with my kids, right, so I have, when I'm with them, I don't take on anything else.
Yeah.
So I'm solid.
You're present.
I'm 100% present, which I was never before. So I think me being present when I'm with them is more valuable to them than being that person who might see them at night going to bed and see them in the morning going to school.
Can I pick up on that in a very important way?
Yeah.
So I know a lot of business people. I do some one-to-one work, and I know a lot of business people, and there's a through line. And the through line is these business people, they're on holidays with the kids and they're on their phones and they're working. And their complaint to me is, I don't know how to be present with my kids. Yeah. So they could be present with the kids or in the presence of their kids 365 days a year, but yet not be present. And that's why I asked the question. I think it's so important what you said is if you have the facility or ability to compartmentalize and actually, if it's only however many days a year, it could be a lot, it could be little, but just if you're actually present, like truly present in the moment. There's beauty in that, but there's also an importance in that for your kids as well.
Yeah. Kids are, I don't know, I'm not going to write the correct terminology here, but kids they know, they're so
intuitive.
Intuitive.
They're clued in.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not stupid.
Yeah. They're so clued in. And they know when you're present or when you're not present. And you know, and that's the part where for me, it's the most important part. So I know I'm detached from them when I'm doing these things.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, the days I do my 5 days out in the wild Lantaway is actually, so I do work with a charity called Lighthouse Charity. So that's 5 days a week I'm gone with them. Well, four.
Yeah.
Half every once a month. And then the 5 days I'm doing wild Lantaway is also the time when I'm not with them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not, as in I'm being taken away from them.
Yeah,
that's when I'm actually not with them, you know. So I arrange everything around their schedule, which is my schedule as well.
Yeah.
You know, now it doesn't work out always perfect like that.
Life isn't perfect. Life is messy. It's the same with me. But I still have to travel loads. Sometimes I travel too much.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Sometimes I don't meet my own expectation of myself and I am absent.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm okay with that, sometimes I'm not. But I think the important thing is if you have an awareness.
Yeah.
The awareness is the key part.
Yeah.
And the awareness of being, do you know what, kids? I'm going to be with you in 3 weeks. And when I'm with you, you don't have to say it to them, but they'll know. And you'll know if you're coming from a place of presence. I think that's so important. Yeah.
And it's very, very good that you say that because, like, obviously, these last few weeks now have been extremely busy for myself. And I was already saying to Kate there, like, I actually felt a bit of anxiety in New York before Project Empower, which I never had before. And I couldn't understand what it was because I've had it now before. There's a little bit of anxiety coming on top of me with all, it wasn't just this, but work and all my adventure planning and the walk across America. And it was all kind of getting, but now because I knew it was anxiety, I was actually able, okay, that's anxiety. I need to shelf it.
Yeah.
Like, which is, you know, is a good thing to be able to do, you know?
Yeah.
But what, again, why I'm saying that is like that, you can't be always that perfect person.
No.
You know? And you just have to roll with it. And I said, once you try it, but being present for the kids, it's since I've learned to be present with them, my relationship with them is so much better. Like, even when we go on holidays, it's just me, the three kids.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
brilliant. And you're able to switch off and be with them.
And I was that man. I remember going to, on holidays skiing, right?
Yeah.
My oldest daughter was only 7 or something like that at the time. And Bradley, Phelan wasn't even born. Bradley was like 5. It was actually just before my accident, actually.
Yeah.
It was 8 months before. And when we went to it, I remember being in an apartment in the evenings and being on the phone, on the emails. Other than the ski part, no other real memories from it.
That's the norm for most people, I think. Yeah. I mean, not most people, but a lot of people out there. Do you know what I mean?
But I won't go back to that.
No. Well, that's why I was about to ask you at the start of this podcast. You said it was the worst thing that ever happened to you, but also the greatest gift.
Yeah.
So how did it end up being the greatest gift? Is it because now you're present with your children and you're doing these amazing endurance stunts? Or what is that greatest gift?
Okay. I'm just lucky. Okay. I got back on my feet. Okay. I'm very lucky. That's number one, I feel that. Number two is, obviously, my time with kids is more precious now than it ever was.
Yeah.
It's also given me a very different outlook on life.
Mm. What way?
Denner H taught me a very big lesson very soon. And that was to appreciate everything you have and don't be envious of everything you don't have.
Yeah.
And how did that come about? I went in there still in my flat, my back, moving a few toes. And I thought I had it bad. But I went into wars with people who were paraplegics, locked-in syndrome, growths in their spinal cords that are never going to heal, and so on and so on. I was still able to push my wheelchair around the place. I was able to feed myself. I was able to eat. I was able to talk. I was able to see. I was able to do all these things. And I've very quickly changed my mindset. I said, man, I am lucky. Because we're born with privileges, but we take them for granted.
Mm.
And that's the way I look at things. Now, I don't always look at it, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I'll still look at the you know, the nice car going down the road, go, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to kill myself to have that anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's not life.
Yeah.
To me, that's not life. You know? So that's why, that would be one of the biggest things why I think I'm very, very lucky. But also, I have a clearer understanding of, I've obviously had a severe disability. I also was completely independent. And now I have a hidden disability. So I have three outlooks on life in the memory bank. So I kind of appreciate people's difficulties a little bit more. And I don't react to situations like I used to. No,
yeah.
Don't get me wrong. It's not always that way. There's times I do overreact and, you know, I'm human. Like
yeah.
You know, everybody is. But I do find myself, you know, saying to myself sometimes, hold on, no need to react to this now. Because they've got something that's going on in their lives or something I don't know about. And that's, you know, so there's all those different viewpoints that I never had, because I told you I was a closed mind.
Yeah.
Now I have a very open mind to all this type of stuff. You know, I don't knock things just because I don't think it would work. I just, you know, that's just the way I am.
And for people listening who might just, for whatever reason, be down and out or down the dumps or just had a tough time of it, like, you're obviously a very resilient character. What would be your, like, top three tips on resilience?
Find out who you are. Don't try to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Step by step, you'll get there. And it's about hard work.
Yeah. So you go back to hard work ethic again.
Yeah. And if you figure out who you are, because, you know, and stick to that.
Yeah.
And rather than, you know, I think that's a huge thing for me as well. As in, like, I just think if you can stay, like, I didn't know who I was until I was 39 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's a huge part now of me going forward. You know, when I feel myself going down the wrong path, I go, hold on, that's me being wanting to be somebody else.
Yeah.
I can pull myself back and say, give myself a slap in the, the wrist, you know.
Before we wrap it up, though, a couple of quick fire things.
Yeah.
COVID-19 and the cold. I read that in the book.
Yeah.
So I always like to bring people into the cold, because I've been practicing cold therapy for a long time before it was hip. So are you still, you mentioned the cold showers obviously earlier. Would we still find you in Salt Hill in the middle of winter jumping in the sea? Or?
You would, but not. It would be irregular.
Yeah.
And that's why I do the cold showers, because I live in Athenry, which is like, it's a 40 minute drive into Salt Hill and 40 minute back out.
I'm sure there's a lake in Athenry they can jump into.
No, there isn't.
Is there not?
No.
You've no lakes in
The river's about a foot deep.
Yeah.
So no, there isn't actually. Would you believe the nearest one?
But you find the benefits.
Lockray, yeah.
But you found the benefits of it.
Oh man, yeah. I did that cold tour for our cold. Sorry, Freesbury.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was February. It's cold. Yeah. And I went in, and I remember, like, obviously when I'm in water, then because I don't feel in the feet.
Yeah.
I have very bad balance altogether, and like, I made myself look like an absolute fool. Like, everybody thought I was drunk coming in and out of the water. Yeah, because you'd fall over,
wobbling all over the place.
And but after doing the month of it, I noticed a massive. Now, when I say my pain was up at 80-90%, I really was struggling with it every day.
Mm.
And after doing that for the month, I noticed a reduction in my pain.
Right,
but it wasn't. So I would have days where I'd be bad, days where would. There's no seen pattern to it. I've never been able to figure out a pattern to that pain.
Right,
you know, one day it spikes, another day it's okay. But after that, I noticed my spikes weren't as high, and definitely the pain levels reduced.
Yeah.
And I have a theory around that, if you don't mind me sharing it. Yeah, no, it's only a theory. Like, you know, because it's like if you put a bag of peas in a fridge,
yeah.
you take it out half an hour later. Well, the outside would be a little bit frosted,
yeah.
but the inside would be still mushy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just put it down that, the internal swelling within that. And again, I would have probably done, while I was in that water, I probably would have visualize that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know that this is healing.
Yeah.
It's reducing the swelling with inside in the body, because you need that bit of longer time in that cold water to do that. And that's what I visualized, that was that moment, that month. Now I've went back and done a bit more cold water, but the pain has always stayed. But I think that maybe that body just needed that time in that cold water to reduce that internal swelling. That hasn't returned after the accident, after the injury. Oh, that's, again, I could be totally stone cracked.
Well, there is. Look, there is science behind the anti-inflammatory benefits of cold therapy. And look, it's a hot topic right now. Saunas, ice baths, it's all out there and they're popping up all over the country. You find me in them. So I'm an advocate and I'm in a lot of pain. Look, on that, do you have a lot of pain still on the daily basis?
Yeah, I'm 24/7 pain. Okay. I only sleep 2 or 3 hours, maybe max 4 hours a night because of the pain. I wake up every half an hour within that time. That's unfortunate. Something that just, you can see I'm rubbing my legs here. And I'm twitching them because that's pain. It's my medication is due now in next hour.
Right, we better wrap it up soon so you can get your medication. Before we wrap it up, final question.
Yeah.
What's in the future for Fergus Farrell? So we've read the book. We know what's in the past.
Yeah,
and we know the walk across America, but give us an exclusive here. What else? Because I can tell there's something else in the back of that brain there, yours. Yeah. So what's the other adventure?
I won't say because it's a bit crazy. But look, I'm enjoying life.
Okay, life is the adventure.
Yeah, and there is something else. Okay. After America. But I have to see how I get on with America first.
Sorry, is America, just so we know, it's 2026. Yeah, so you've already planned that then? Or it's in planning?
Yeah, it's all in the planning. All steam ahead. That's why I'm doing Wild Atlantic Way.
How can we support the Wild Atlantic Way? How can we support your walk across America? What's the best way to watch your progress on those things?
Okay, so all the stuff around America, it's actually been officially launched in January.
Okay.
Okay, so they're still working on all that because that's in conjunction with Spinal Injuries Ireland.
Yeah.
But my own personal trainer for that is there's an I Donate page, just I Donate Fergus Farrell.
Okay.
And now, but all that is all going to Spinal Injuries Ireland. So it is.
Amazing.
And it's not really been advertised or promoted because it's just a training program for America. But there is people on it who's donated, who has made a contribution and stuff like that because they've met me on the road or whatever else, or they've seen me on social media tag, putting up all the amazing pictures of the beaches and around our west coast of Ireland is just spectacular.
Oh yeah, I'm always down on the Wild Atlantic Way.
Oh man,
I'm always down there. You know?
So I've walked now the Wild Atlantic Way. It took me 2 days, which the Echo Line is huge.
Yeah,
2 days it took me to walk actually the whole lot of the Wild Atlantic Way. Yeah, so I've seen all. Obviously everybody knows about Kiel and Keen Bay.
Yeah, I didn't go near them. I found the weird one that nobody goes to. You have to walk down this weird path. I can't remember the name of it now.
Yeah, well, I probably actually don't think I've seen that one, but like. One of the most best experiences I've ever had in that Wild Atlantic Way. Well, I won't say the best experience, but like just the people are fantastic. Chris, who's the CEO of Ackle Tourism, they knew that no one that I was coming in doing the walk, and he walking by the office, they said just pop in. So I popped in and actually they gave me a T-shirt and thing and said congratulations, best of luck on it. But that was grand. I continued on my journey, and later on that day, I was walking up this road, and next thing this guy in a van. Pulls over and I look in and there is Chris. Yeah. He said, "Oh, you're right beside my house. Come in for a cup of tea." Brilliant. And I mean, I went into this house and the view out the window was like Hollywood. You couldn't get better.
Yeah.
And I was going, and then sat down, had the cup of tea with him, and the wife was there, his daughter was there, and her boyfriend. And like the most amazing chat. But like that's people. People are good. But we think they're all the bad things, unfortunately, And that's what I've discovered. Like, I knew I would, anyways. But that's the beauty of walking the Wild Atlantic Way. I've went into so many houses now at this stage for cups of teas. But years ago, with that closed mind, I would have said no.
Right. Yeah. I would
continue on my journey.
Yeah.
I want to get this done. But now I'm really open to.
But isn't that lovely? Just meeting those people and meeting good people along the way.
Yeah.
And tell us, what is your Instagram handle, or where is the best social media platform? Is it Instagram or?
Yeah, so I am Fergus Farrell on Instagram, and then it's just Fergus Farrell in LinkedIn. Yeah.
And the book?
So it's Rebuilding a Man. It's by Gil Books, and Luiso and Caelan wrote it with me.
Yeah.
And it's out since last Wednesday.
And I read it this week. Absolutely fantastic read. There's lots more that we haven't had time to talk about here today. But Fergus, I'll be supporting you. And thank you so much for being on Open Mind. And I like the fact that you mentioned being open-minded about three times on Open Mind. So Fergus Farrell, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Keith.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow, rate and share wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show and it means the world to us. Thanks for listening.